Chapter 15. I sat up all night. My brain ran through the same old paces like a chipmunk in a cage. I always ended with the same conclusion. Eric was trying to get me to admit I had the Cluvial Door. What would have happened if I'd understood him last night, if I'd admitted it? Would he have taken it from me? I didn't know if he simply sought it for himself, or if Freda would barter the Cluvial Door in return for Eric's services, or if Eric simply wanted me to use it to stop him from going to Oklahoma. And here's what happens when you have too much time to think. I actually considered the idea that Eric might have engineered this whole episode with Freda to get me to reveal the location of the Cluvial Door. That was a sickening possibility. If I hadn't experienced past betrayals, such an idea would never have crossed my mind. Even though I had accepted the world as it was, it made me sad that I was sure such a long-term and planned deception was possible. Every new thought seemed to be worse than the previous one. I lay in the dark, watching the clock change. I tried to think of things I could do, something besides lie in this bed. I could run across the cemetery to talk to Bill, who was surely up. That was a terrible idea, and I discarded it the first 10 times it occurred to me. The 11th time, I actually got out of bed and walked to the back door before I made myself turn away. I knew if I went over to talk to Bill right now, something might happen that I would surely regret, and that wasn't fair to me or Eric, not until I knew for sure. I really knew for sure. I opened my purse and took the Cluvial Door into my hand. Its warm, smooth surface relieved my pain, calmed me. I didn't know if I could trust this feeling or not, but it was far preferable to my previous misery. I heard Dermot come in and walk very quietly through the house. I couldn't bear the idea of explaining the situation, so I didn't let him know I was awake. When he was safely upstairs, I moved into my dark living room and waited for the dawn. I fell asleep just as the night was lightening gradually into day. I slept sitting up on the couch until I woke 4 hours later, a cramp in my neck and stiffness in all my joints. I got up, feeling like I imagined an old woman felt first thing in the morning. I unlocked the front door and stepped out onto the porch. I heard birds singing, and the heat of the day was well advanced. Life was trudging onward. Since I couldn't think of what else to do, I went into the kitchen and started a pot of coffee. At least I didn't have to go to work today, since Merlot's was closed on Sunday. The night before, I had tossed our weekly local newspaper on the table unread. So while I sipped the coffee, I took off the rubber band and spread it out. It was only a few pages, a little tube compared to the Shreveport daily paper, which I also read. Often the Bon Ton paper had news that was more interesting, though. That was the case today. "Bear in local woods?" read the headline. I skimmed the article hastily, and my heart sank, if there were any lower depths to hold it. Two deer carcasses found by local men had led to some excited speculation. "Some large predator did this," said Terry Belfleur, who happened upon one of the killing sites while training his dog. "It didn't exactly look like a bear or panther kill, but this deer was killed by something big." "Damn it, I'd warned Bellinos to stick to my woods." "Oh, I didn't have quite enough to worry about," I said, rising to pour some more coffee. "I needed something else."
"What are you worried about?" Claude asked.
I screamed, and my coffee mug went flying. When I could speak, I said, "You do not do that to me." He must have come in through the unlocked front door. He had keys, anyway, but I would have heard them in the lock and had some warning.
"Cousin, I'm sorry," he said contritely, but I could see the amusement in his eyes.
Oh, shit. Where had I put the Cluvial Door? I'd left it on the coffee table in the living room. It took every bit of self-control I had not to break and run for the living room. "Claude," I said, "things haven't been going well while you were gone." I struggled to make my voice level. "Some of your Fey workers have been taking little vacations." I pointed to the paper. "I guess Dermot spent the night at Hooligan's. You should read this." If he hadn't come through the backyard, he might not have seen Dermot's car. Claude poured himself a cup of coffee and obediently pulled out a chair.
His actions weren't threatening, but I was looking at the man who'd sent Kim Rowe to her death. For all I knew, he was the one who'd killed her when she hadn't gotten Eric to do the job. Claude's sudden reappearance, without Niall, would have been enough to raise the hair on my arms even if I hadn't known about his collusion with Janelin. Why had Claude returned by himself? There was something in his face that hadn't been there before. I was willing him to sit down, willing him to give me the time to walk into the living room and retrieve the magical object. "Where's Niall?" I asked, picking up my mug, which, amazingly, hadn't broken. After I put it by the sink, I got a wad of paper towels to mop up the spilled coffee. "Still in Faerie," Claude said, ostensibly concentrating on the paper. "Oh, did you like your friend's act at Hooligans, your human friend?"
"J.B., well, his wife and I were surprised, him being the only human and her not knowing he was doing it and all."
"He needed a job, and I remembered the pretty lady who was with child," Claude said. "See, I did a good thing. I'm not so bad."
"I never said you were."
"You look at me, though, from time to time, as if you can't understand why I get to breathe the same air you do." I was genuinely staggered.
"Claude, I'm so sorry if I've ever given the impression I thought you were worthless. Certainly I don't feel that way."
"Or did I?"
"No, I didn't. I thought he was selfish and charmless and maybe guilty of murder, but that was different."
"You don't want to have sex with me. If you had more Fey blood, you certainly would want it."
"But I don't. You're gay. I'm in love with someone else. I don't believe in having sex with relatives. We've had this conversation before. I really, really don't want to have it again."
The feeling of wrongness and badness kept growing. Especially after my experience with the Rogue Wares, I knew better than to ignore it. I also knew Claude was stronger than I was, and I assumed he had skills I'd never seen.
"Okay," he said. "You're trying to let me know that my kith and kin are hunting at night? Is that the point of giving me this newspaper?"
"Yes, Claude, that's the point. Dermot's about been nuts, trying to keep them in line. Didn't I all get the letter I sent?"
"I don't know," Claude said. I was bewildered.
"I thought you went back with Niall to investigate who'd cast the crazy spell on Dermot," I said. "He's been spending lots of nights at the club and trying real hard to keep things running." I was frightened for myself, of course, but I was frightened for Dermot, too. I hoped Dermot was awake by now. Claude wouldn't take my word for it that Dermot wasn't there. He'd go up to check. "So what have you been doing in Faerie? Did you ever find out who cast the spell?"
"Niall and I had some disagreements," Claude said, his beautiful dark eyes flashing up to meet mine. "I'm sorry to say that Niall believes it was me who cursed Dermot." I was left with no response, since I was by now pretty sure myself that Claude was the culprit.
"I think that's awful," I said, with absolute sincerity. He could take it as he chose. "I'm going to go open the shades in the living room. Have some more coffee. I think I've got some toaster strudels in the freezer if you're hungry."
I walked down the hall to the living room, trying not to hurry, trying to make my footsteps regular and nonchalant. I even went directly to one of the front windows and raised the blind.
"It's going to be a pretty day,"
I called, turned, and in one gesture swept up the colluvial door and put it in my nightshirt pocket. Dermot was halfway down the stairs. He said, "Did I hear Claude's voice?" and made as if to hurry past me. Apparently, he hadn't even looked at what I'd picked up, which was a relief, but not at the top of my list of problems just at the moment.
"Yes, he's home," I said, in what I hoped was a natural voice, but I gripped Dermot's arm as he went by me. I looked at him with as much warning as I could pack into my eyes.
Dermot's blue eyes, so like Jason's, widened in shock. There was no gesture I could make that would clearly translate as, "I think he wants to do something awful to us. He killed Kim Rowe for some reason I can't fathom, and I think he cursed you." But at least Dermot understood that caution was called for.
"I told him you weren't here," I whispered. He nodded.
"Claude," he called, "where have you been? Sookie didn't hear me come in last night, she says. The other Fey are champing at the bit to hear your news."
He started toward the kitchen, but he met Claude coming into the living room. I didn't think Claude had witnessed our silent colloquy, but at this point I wouldn't put money on anything good.
Yesterday had been my good day, apparently, even though it had ended as badly as I thought it could have. I'd been wrong. Claude could have returned last night. Yep, that would have been worse.
Dermot, said Claude. His voice was so cold it stopped Dermot dead. I went on and opened the other blind.
What's wrong? Why have you returned without father? Dermot said.
Grandfather has issues he must deal with, Claude snarled, in fairy.
What did you do?
Dermot asked. He was brave. I was trying to unobtrusively creep into my room to retrieve my cell phone. I didn't know whom I would call. I didn't know who could deal with a fairy.
What did you do, Claude?
I thought that when I went back with him, I would find support for our program, Claude said.
Uh-oh, I didn't like the sound of that. I took two more steps to my left.
Hooligans! I'd call the Fae at Hooligans! Wait, unless they were backing Claude and whatever the hell his program was. Shit, what should I do? Dermot wasn't armed. He was wearing sleep pants and no shirt. My shotgun was in the closet by the front door. Maybe the closet should be my goal, instead of the cell phone. Did I have Hooligans on speed dial? How long would it take the police to get out here if I hit 911? Would Claude kill them?
And you didn't? Dermot said. I'm not sure what program you mean, Claude.
You naive simpleton, Claude said scathingly. How hard have you worked at ignoring what was going on all around you so you could stay with us?
Claude was just being mean now. If I'd had any sleep, I wouldn't have snapped then, but I hadn't, and I did.
Claude Crane, you are just being an A-number-one asshole, I exploded, and you shut up right now.
I had succeeded in startling Claude, and he turned his gaze on me for just a second, but Dermot took advantage of that second to hit Claude as hard as he could, which proved to be plenty hard. Claude lurched to his right, and Dermot kept punching. Of course, the element of surprise was gone after the first blow. Claude had another skill besides stripping. He could fight dirty. The two launched into it, two beautiful men doing something so ugly I could hardly bear to watch. The heaviest thing around was a lamp that had belonged to my great-grandmother. With a flash of reluctance, I picked it up. I proposed to bash Claude's head in, if I got the opportunity. But then, my back door flew open, and Belenos bounded through my kitchen and down the hall. He had a true sword in his hand, instead of his deer-hunting spear. Gift was with him, long knives in both her hands. Three more of the Monroe Fae were with them, two of the strippers, the fairy policeman, and the part demon who'd worn leather when he'd come on stage. The curvy ticket-taker followed. She hadn't bothered with looking human today.
"Help Dermot!"
I yelled, hoping that was what they'd come to do. To my overwhelming relief, they whooped with excitement and threw themselves into the brawl. There was a lot of unnecessary punching and biting, but when they were sure Claude was subdued, they all began laughing, even Dermot. At least I was able to put the lamp back on the table.
"Would someone tell me what's going on?"
I asked. I felt, as usual with the Supes, two steps behind the crowd, and no telepath enjoys feeling that way. I was gonna have to hang around with humans for a long time to make up for this sad ignorance.
"My dearest sister," Belenos said.
He smiled that disconcerting smile at me. He looked especially toothy today, and since there was blood between some of those teeth, the effect was not reassuring.
"Hi, y'all,"
was the best I could do, but they all grinned back, and Gift gave Dermot an enthusiastic kiss. Her extra eyelid flickered down and up again, almost too fast for me to note. In the meantime, Claude was lying on the floor in a panting, bloody bundle. There was still plenty of fight in him from the glares he was throwing around, but he was so clearly outnumbered that it seemed he'd given up, at least temporarily. The ticket taker was sitting on his legs, and the two strippers were each pinning one arm. Gift came to sit by me. I'd collapsed on the couch. She put her arm around me.
"Claude was trying to incite us to rebel against Niall," she said kindly. "Sister, I'm surprised he didn't try to test your loyalty, too."
"Well, he wouldn't have gotten very far," I said. "I would have thrown him out in a New York minute."
"Then see, that was intelligent of you, Claude," said Belenos, bending over to speak to Claude face to face. "One of the few intelligent things you did."
Claude glared at him.
Dermot shook his handsome head.
All this time, I thought I must try to emulate Claude, because he had been so successful out here in the human world. But I realized that when he thought people were pleased with him, he didn't perceive that it was only because he is beautiful. Much more often, when he talked to people, they came to regard him with dislike. I couldn't believe it, but he'd done well in spite of himself, not because of his own talents.
He does like children, I said weakly, and he's nice to pregnant women.
Yes, that's true, the policeman stripper said. By the way, you can just call me Dirk, my stripping name. Siobhan is sitting on Claude's legs, and this is Harley. I'm sure you remember Harley.
Oh, yeah, who could forget Harley, I said. Even under the circumstances, I had a gratifying flashback of how Harley's straight black hair and coppery red body had looked under the lights at Hooligan's. Harley tried to bow from a crouching position, which isn't easy, and Siobhan grinned at me. So, Claude really was locked out of Fairy, along with you all? That wasn't a lie?
No, not a lie, said Dermot sadly. My father hated me because he thought I'd always worked against him, but I was cursed. I thought he'd done the cursing, but I see now it must have been Claude all along. Claude, you betrayed me and then kept me trotting behind you like a dog.
Claude began to speak in another language, and then the Fae moved with an unbelievable speed. Gift yanked off her bra top, and Harley stuffed it in Claude's mouth. It would have been petty of me to take any notice of Gift's bare chest, so I rose above it.
That was a secret fairy language?
I hated to ask, but I just wanted to know. My days of ignorance were over. Dirk nodded.
We speak to each other that way. It's what we have in common. Full fairy, demon, angel, all the half-breeds.
Dermot, did you and Claude really come here because of my fairy blood? I asked Dermot.
Claude's mouth was otherwise occupied.
Yes, Dermot said uncertainly, though Claude said there was something here that attracted him, and he spent hours when you were gone searching your house. When he couldn't find what he wanted here, he thought perhaps it was in the furniture you sold. He went to that shop and broke in to examine all the furniture again.
I felt a little bubble of rage float to the top of my brain. Though I was nice enough to let him live with me, he searched my house, went through my stuff, while I was gone. Dermot nodded. From the guilty glance he gave me, I was pretty damn sure Claude had enlisted my great-uncle in his search.
What was he looking for?
Harley asked curiously.
He sensed a fairy object in Sookie's house, a fairy influence.
They all looked at me, simultaneously, with sharp attention.
Gran, you all know my fairy blood comes from my grandmother and Fenton, right?
They all nodded and blinked. I was sure glad I hadn't been trying to keep that a secret.
Gran was friends with Mr. Cataliades through Fenton.
They nodded again, more slowly.
He left something here, but when he stopped by a few days ago, he picked it up.
They appeared to accept that pretty well. At least no one leaped up to say, "You liar, you have it in your pocket." Claude thrashed on the floor. Clearly, he wanted to put in his 2 cents worth, and I was glad the bra was in his mouth.
If I'm getting to ask questions, I said, waiting for Bellanos to interrupt, to tell me my time was up, but that didn't happen. Claude, I know you tried to sabotage me and Eric, but I don't know why.
Dirk raised interrogative eyebrows. Did I want him to remove the gag?
Maybe you can just let me know if I get something right, I suggested, hoping that the gag stayed in. Did you go to Janilyn for help because you wanted to enlist a shifter of some kind?
Glaring at me, Claude nodded.
Who's that?
Dermot whispered, as if the air would answer him.
Janilyn Hopper is the second of the Longtooth Pack in Shreveport, I said. She's been dating my boss, Sam Merlot, but she hates me, which is a long story for some other time, though it's pretty boring. Anyway, I knew she'd love to do me a bad turn if she could, and the young woman who got murdered in Eric's front yard turned out to be a half-ware with a death wish and severe financial problems, ripe for a desperate plan, I figure.
Claude,
You gave her some of your blood to make her alluring to Eric, I think.
The Fae all looked absolutely aghast. I couldn't have said anything more abhorrent to them.
You gave your sacred blood to a mongrel?
Hissed Gift and kicked Claude heartily. Claude closed his eyes and nodded. Maybe he wanted them to kill him on the spot. Kim Rowe hadn't been the only person to develop a wish to die.
So I get how you did it, but why? Why did you want Eric to lose control? What benefit to you?
Oh, I know that one, Dermot said brightly.
I sighed. Maybe you would explain.
Claude told me several times that if we could get Niall to return to your side, we could attack him here in the human world, where he wouldn't be surrounded by his supporters, Dermot said. But I ignored his scheming. I was sure Niall wouldn't return and couldn't return because he was firm in his resolution to stay in Faerie. But Claude argued that Niall loves you so much that if something happened to you, he'd come to your side. So he tried to ruin Eric, thinking that at best you and Eric would fight and Eric would hurt you, or you'd be arrested for murdering him and you'd need your great-grandfather. At the very least, you would throw Eric aside and your misery would bring Niall running.
I was pretty miserable, I said slowly, and I was even more miserable last night.
And here I am, said a voice I recognized. I've come in response to your letter, which opened my eyes to many things.
He was glowing. My great-grandfather hadn't troubled with his human appearance either. The white blonde hair floated in the air around him. His face was radiant, his eyes like fairy lights on a white tree. The little cluster of Fae in my living room fell to their knees. He put his arms around me, and I felt his incredible beauty, his terrifying magic, and his crazy devotion. There was nothing human about him. He put his mouth right by my ear.
I know you have it, he said.
Suddenly, we were standing in my bedroom instead of in the living room.
You gonna take it?
I asked, in the smallest possible voice. Those were Fae in the living room. They might hear.
Don't even show it to me, he said. It was from my son to his loved one. He intended it for a human. It should stay in human hands.
But you really, really want it.
I do, and I have very poor impulse control.
Okay, no looks. Danger. I was trying to relax, but it's not easy loving and being loved by a powerful prince who has no human frame of reference. Furthermore, one whose great age has kind of unhinged him, just a little bit, from time to time.
What will happen to the Fae in my living room?
I will take them with me, Niall said. I have taken care of a lot of things while Claude was with me. I never let him know what I already understood about him. I know what happened to Dermot. I have forgiven Dermot.
Okay, that was good. Will you close Faerie for good?
Soon,
he whispered, his lips again uncomfortably close to my ear.
You have not asked yet who told your lover that you have the object.
That would be a good thing for me to learn.
You need to know.
His arms grew uncomfortably tight around me. I made myself relax against him.
It was me,
Niall said, almost inaudibly. I jerked back as if he'd pinched my butt.
What?
The brilliant eyes bored into mine.
You had to know, he said. You had to know what would happen if he believed you had power.
Please tell me you didn't engineer the whole Appius thing.
That would be more than I could bear.
No. Eric is unfortunate in that people feel the need to take him down a peg, including his own maker. The Roman wanted to keep control over so vital a being even after his own death, which became far more likely once he turned the child, so unstable. Appius Livius Ocella made mistakes in his whole long existence. Perhaps changing Eric was his finest hour. He created the perfect vampire. Eric's only flaw is you.
But I couldn't think of what I'd been about to say.
Of course, that's not how I perceive it, dearest. You are the one right impulse Eric has had in 500 years or more. Well, Pam is all right. Even Eric's other living child does not rival her maker.
Thanks, I said numbly, the words not sinking in at all. So you knew Appius?
We met. He was a stinking Roman asshole.
True.
I was glad when he died. Out in your front yard, wasn't it?
Yes.
The ground around your house has become soaked with blood. It will add to its magic and fertility.
What happens now? I said, because I simply couldn't think of what else to say. He lifted me and carried me out of the bedroom like I was a baby. It didn't feel like the times when Eric had carried me, which had had a definitely carnal edge. This was incredibly tender and, like a lot of things about my great-grandfather, incredibly creepy. He put me on the couch as carefully as if I were an egg.
This is what happens next,
he told me. He turned to the other Fae, still on their knees. Claude had stopped thrashing and was looking up at Niall with resignation. For the moment, Niall ignored his grandson.
Do you all want to go home?
He asked the others.
Yes, Prince, said Dirk. Please, with our kindred waiting at Claude's club, if we may, if you will.
Dermot said,
With your blessing, I'll stay here, Father.
For a moment, they all looked at Dermot incredulously, as if he'd just announced he was going to birth a kangaroo. Niall folded Dermot to him. I could see Dermot's face, and it was ecstatic, frightened, everything I had felt in Niall's embrace. Niall said,
You won't be a fairy anymore. The American Fae are all leaving. Choose.
The conflict on Dermot's face was painful to see.
Suki, he said, who can finish your upstairs work?
I'll hire Terry Belfleur, I said. He won't be as good as you, Dermot.
No television, Dermot said. I'll miss HGTV.
Then he smiled.
But I can't live without my essence, and I am your son, Niall.
Niall beamed down at Dermot, which was what Dermot had wanted his whole life. I got up because I couldn't stand to have him leave without a hug. I even started crying, which I hadn't expected. They all kissed me, even Belenos, though I felt his teeth scrape lightly on my cheek, and I felt his chest move in a silent chuckle. Niall made some mysterious signs over my head and closed his eyes, just like a priest giving a blessing. I felt something change in the house, the land. And then they were gone. Even Claude. I was stupefied. I was willing to bet that over at Hooligan's, the bar stood empty, the doors locked. The Fae were gone from America. Their departure point? Fonton, Louisiana. The woods behind my house. Chapter 16. As you can imagine, it wasn't easy to go on and have a normal day after that. I hadn't slept all night, and the traumas had just kept on coming. But after I showered and straightened up the living room, which had suffered a bit during the fight, I found myself sitting at the kitchen table trying to absorb everything, last night, this morning. It was taking a lot of energy to do that. About halfway through setting my mental house in order, I had to think about something else. Luckily, there was something right in front of me that would serve. Among the presents I tossed to the table last night was Pam's little box, Bill's box, and Sam's envelope, which I'd never examined. Pam had given me perfume, and I liked the smell of it very much. Bill had given me a necklace with a cameo pendant. The likeness on it was my grand's. Oh, Bill, I said, you did great. Nothing could top such a gift, I thought, as I reached for Sam's envelope. I figured he'd picked a fancy birthday card, with maybe a gift certificate enclosed. Sam had officially made me a partner in the bar. I legally owned a third of Merlot's. I put my head on the table and swore, in a happy way. This past 24 hours had been my personal trail of tears. No more. I picked myself up out of that chair, slapped on about a ton of makeup and a sundress, and put a smile on my face. It was time to rejoin the land of the living, the everyday world. I didn't want to learn one more secret or suffer one more betrayal. I was due to meet Kennedy for breakfast at LaLaurie's, which, she told me, served a great Sunday brunch. I didn't think I'd ever eaten a meal and called it brunch. Today I did, and it was really excellent. White tablecloths and cloth napkins, too. Kennedy was wearing a pretty sundress, too, and her hair was in full pageant mode. The hickey on her neck was not quite covered by her makeup. Kennedy was in an excellent mood, and she confided in me way more than I wanted to know about the wonderfulness that now lay between Danny and her. Danny was even now running errands for Bill Compton, since he didn't have to work at the lumberyard, which was closed on Sunday. It was gonna work out. He'd be making a living wage. When their finances stabilized, maybe they would move in together. Maybe, she emphasized, but I wasn't fooled. Their cohabitation was a done deal. I thought of my happy fantasies of the night before. Had it really just been the night before? I tried to remember all the happy endings I'd imagined for everyone, and I tried to recollect if I'd included Danny and Kennedy in the roundup. After I left LaLaurie's, full and happy, I knew I couldn't wait any longer to thank Sam for his amazing gift. His truck was parked in front of his trailer. His carefully watered hedge and yard were flourishing despite the heat. Not many men would try to keep a yard around their double wide if it was parked behind a bar. I'd always tried to let Sam's house be his house. I could count on my fingers the times I'd knocked on his door. Today was one of them. When he answered the door, my smile faded away. I could tell something was mighty wrong. Then I realized that he knew what Janilyn had done. He looked at me bleakly.
"I don't know what to say to you," he said. "This is the second time I've been with a woman who tried to do you harm."
It actually took me a second to remember who the other one had been. Callisto? Oh, Sam, that was a while ago, and she was hardly a woman. She didn't mean any of it personal. Janilyn, well, she definitely did. But she's an ambitious young woman. She's trying... My voice trailed off. She's trying to take over the pack from her packmaster to whom she swore loyalty. She's trying to make sure my boyfriend gets arrested for murder. She conspired with a fairy to pay Kim Rowe to go to her death. She kidnapped Warren. She left him to die. She was trying to kill me one way or another. Okay, I said, conceding defeat. You fucked up with Janilyn. He blinked at me. His reddish-blonde hair was standing up like porcupine quills all over his head. He tilted his head to one side, as if he wasn't sure I was quite in focus. His mouth quirked up in an unwilling grin. I grinned back. Then we both laughed. Not a lot, but enough to clear the air. "Where is she?" I asked. "Do you know what happened night before last?"
"Tell me," he said, standing aside so I could come in.
Sam had heard a sketchy version from a pack member who'd become a friend of his, a young man who worked for Janilyn at Hair of the Dog.
"You didn't tell me what you suspected about her," Sam said.
He left that sitting there between us. "Sam, let me tell you about what's happened the last couple of days, and you'll understand, I promise," I said, and with a certain amount of editing, I told him.
"Good God, Sookie," he said. "You really know how to have a birthday, huh?"
"The best part of my birthday was my present from you," I said, and I took his hand. Sam turned red.
"Aw, Sook, you earned it. You deserve it. And look, I didn't make you equal partner, did I?"
"Trying to make your gift look like less won't work for me," I said. I kissed him on the cheek and got up to make the moment lighten so Sam would be more comfortable. "I got to get home," I said, though I couldn't imagine what for.
"See you tomorrow."
It would be a lot sooner than that. I felt curiously blank on the drive home to my empty house. For what seemed like forever, my spare time had been taken up by Eric. We were making plans to meet, or we were together, or we were talking on the telephone. Now that it seemed our relationship was unraveling, I had no idea what to expect from our next meeting. if we had a next meeting. But I couldn't imagine how I would fill the hole in my life left by his absence. Now that I knew who tried to get Eric into trouble, I knew that his involvement with me had led to this moment. He'd never have been targeted by Claude, by Janilyn, if it hadn't been for me. And that was such a reversal on the usual situation. I'd been the object of so many schemes because Eric was my lover that I couldn't quite wrap my head around it. I wondered how much Eric knew of what had transpired, but I couldn't bring myself to call him to tell about it all. He had known I had the Cluvial door, and he had expected me to use it to get him out of the arrangement Appius had made with Freyda. And maybe I would have done that. Maybe I still would. It seemed the obvious choice, the most apparent thing to do with the magic. But it also seemed to me that Eric was expecting me to magically get him out of a situation that he should defeat by his own efforts. He should love me enough to simply refuse Freyda. It was like he wanted the decision out of his hands. That was an idea I didn't want to have. But you can't erase a thought. Once you've had it, it's there to stay. I would love to feel an absolute conviction that yanking that Cluvial door out of my pocket and wishing with all my heart that Eric would stay with me was the right thing to do. I poked at that thought. I prodded that thought. But it just didn't feel right to me. I took a much-needed nap. When I got up, though I wasn't really all that hungry, I microwaved a dish of lasagna and picked at it as I thought. No one at the bar had heard news of any more mysterious deer deaths, and now I was sure there never would be. I wondered about hooligans, presumably now sitting empty, but it wasn't anything to do with me anymore. Oh gosh, the guys were sure to have left some stuff upstairs. Maybe this evening I'd pack it up, not that there was any address to forward it to. Okay, maybe I take the clothes to Goodwill. I watched television for a while. An old black-and-white movie about a man and a woman who loved one another but had to overcome all sorts of things to be together, a cooking show, a couple of episodes of Jeopardy. I couldn't get any answers right. My only phone call was from a fundraising organization. I turned them down. They were disappointed in me. I could tell. When the phone rang again, I picked it up without bothering to turn down the sound on the TV.
"Sookie?"
said a familiar voice. I pressed the off button on the remote.
"Alcide, how's Warren?"
"He's much better. I think he's gonna be fine. Listen, I need you and Sam to come to the old farm tonight."
"Your dad's place?"
"Yeah, your presence was requested."
"By whom?"
"By Janilyn."
"You found her?"
"Yeah."
"But Sam, too? She wants Sam?"
"Yeah, she deceived him, too. He has a right to be there."
"Did you call him?"
"He's on his way to pick you up."
"Do I have to?"
I said. "You whining, Sookie?"
"Yeah, I guess I am, Alcide. I'm mighty tired, and more bad stuff has happened than you know."
"I can't take any more than I have on my plate. Just come. If it makes you want to attend this little soiree more, your honey's gonna be there."
"Eric?"
"Yeah, the king of cold himself."
Fear and longing rippled along my skin. "Okay," I said, "I'll come." By the time I heard Sam's truck in the driveway, the lack of sleep I'd experienced the night before was hitting me in a major way. I'd spent the minutes I'd waited by refreshing my memory about the route to Alcide's family place, and I'd written the directions out. When Sam knocked on the door, I stuck the paper in my purse, and I felt the now familiar, curved shape. We were going to be walking around a farm at night. I'd want to leave my purse in the car. I made certain the Cluvial door was still in my pocket. Sam's face was grim and hard, and it felt wrong to see him that way. We didn't talk on the way to the farm. I had to turn on Sam's overhead light from time to time to read my directions, but I was able to steer us right. I think the preoccupation with actually getting there helped keep us from worrying too much about what we'd see when we arrived. We found a mess of cars parked higgledy-piggledy in the front yard of the old farmhouse. To call it remote was to be kind. Though there was more cleared land around it than there had ever been at my place, it was even more private. No one lived here full-time any longer. Alcide's dad's dad had owned the farm, and Jackson Hervaux had kept it after he'd gone into construction so he'd have a place to run at the full moon. The pack had used it often. The front of the house was dark, but I could hear voices around the back. Sam and I trudged through the high weeds. We didn't say a word to each other. We might as well have walked into another country. The meadow behind the house was mowed and smooth. There were lights up. I could see from posts that normally there was a volleyball net set up across a sand court. A few yards away, there was a pool that looked new. I even spotted a baseball diamond farther back. A Weber grill was under the covered patio. Clearly, this was where the pack came to relax and have fellowship. I saw the tall and quiet Candace first. She smiled at me and pointed to Alcide, who stood out among his people as much as Niall did among his. Tonight, Alcide looked like a king in jeans and a t-shirt, a barefoot king, and he looked dangerous. The power gathered around him. The air was humming with the magic of the pack. Good, we needed more tension. Eric shone like the moon. He was pale and commanding, and there was a large empty space around him. He was alone. He held out his hand to me, and I took it, to a flare of dismay from the Tuies. You know? About Chanelin and Claude? I looked up at him.
Yes, I know. Niall sent me a message.
He's gone. They've all gone.
He told me I would not hear from him again.
I nodded and gulped. No more crying. So what's going to happen tonight?
I don't know what we're here to see, he said. An execution? A duel? With the wolves, I can't predict.
Sam was standing by himself, just under the awning over the patio. Alcide went up to him and spoke, and Sam shrugged, then nodded. He stepped out to stand by Alcide. I looked around at the faces of the pack members. They were all restless because of the night and because of the promise of violence in the air. There was going to be bleeding tonight. Alcide raised an arm, and four figures were led from the back of the house. Their hands were bound. Van, Plump, the bandaged airman, Laidlaw, Mustafa had called him, and Janelin. I didn't know where they'd caught up with her, but her face was bruised. She'd put up a fight, which was no surprise at all. Then I saw Mustafa. He'd blended with the darkness. He was magnificently nude. Warren was in the shadows behind him, huddled in a folding lawn chair. He was too far away for me to get a good look at him. Mustafa had a sword. Too many of those in my life these days, I thought, feeling Eric's cold hand tightening on mine.
We are here to judge tonight, Alcide said. We've had to judge members all too often lately. The pack has been full of dissension and disloyalty. Tonight, I require all of you to renew your oaths, and tonight I say that the penalty for breaking them is death.
The werewolves drew in breath sharply, collectively, like a single quiet scream. I looked around. Werewolfism manifests itself along with puberty, so none of the faces were younger than early teens, but that was young enough to make their presence shocking.
After the judgments are rendered tonight, anyone who likes can challenge me on this spot, Alcide said. His face was savage. No candidate has announced against me, but if anyone would like to win here and now, without a ceremony, you're welcome to try single combat. Prepare yourself to fight to the death.
Everyone was frozen in place now. This was not at all like the Packmaster challenge I'd seen before, the one in which Alcide's father had died. That had been a formal, ceremonial contest. Alcide himself had succeeded to the position when his father's challenger, Patrick Fernan, had died fighting side by side with Alcide against a common enemy. Packmaster by acclamation, I guess you'd term it. Tonight, Alcide was throwing down the gauntlet to every wolf present. It was a big gamble.
Now for judgment, Alcide said, when he had looked into the face of every pack member.
The prisoners were pushed forward to land on their knees in the sand of the volleyball court. Roy, the ware who was dating Palomino, seemed to be in charge of the miscreants.
The three rogues I had turned down for admission into the pack acted against us, Alcide said in a voice that carried across the yard. They abducted Warren, the friend of Mustafa, who in turn is a friend, though not a member of this pack. If he hadn't been found in time, Warren would have died.
Everyone moved in unison, turning to stare at the people on their knees.
The three rogues were incited by Janelin Hopper, not only a pack member, but also my enforcer. Janelin couldn't subdue her pride and ambition. She couldn't wait until she was strong enough to challenge me openly. Instead, she started a campaign of undermining me. She looked for power in the wrong places. She even accepted money from a fairy in return for finding a half-bitch who would try to get Eric Northman arrested for murder. When Eric was too smart to act the way she thought he would, Janelin stole into his yard and murdered Kim Rowe herself so Kim wouldn't tell the police who'd hired her. Some of you remember running with Oscar, Kim's father. He's joined us tonight.
Kim's father, Oscar, was skulking behind Alcide. He looked oddly out of place, and I wondered how long it had been since he'd come to a pack meeting. What regrets did Oscar have now about his daughter's life and death? If he was any kind of father, any kind of human being, he had to be thinking about how she'd lost her job, how she'd needed money so badly that she'd agreed to be bait for a vampire. He had to be wondering if he could have helped her out. But maybe I was just projecting. I had to keep my mind in the here and now.
Janelin was willing to sacrifice were-blood to serve her own interests and those of the Fae? Roy said.
I was pretty sure Alcide had prepped him to ask that.
She was. She admits it. She has written a confession and mailed it to the Shreveport police station. Now we're going to ensure it's taken seriously.
Alcide dialed a number. His cell was on speakerphone. Detective Amberselli, said a recognizable voice. Alcide held the phone in front of Janelin. Her eyes closed for a moment as she was readying herself to step off a cliff. The wearer said,
Detective, this is Janelin Hopper.
Uh-huh. Wait, you're the bartender at Hair of the Dog, right?
Yeah, I have a confession to make.
Then come on in and we'll sit down, Amberselli said cautiously.
I can't do that. I'm about to vanish. And I've mailed you a letter. But I wanted to tell you so you can hear it's my voice. Are you recording this?
Yeah, I am now, Amberselli said. I could hear a lot of movement on her end.
I killed Kim Rowe. I came up on her when she was leaving Eric Northman's house, and I snapped her neck. I'm a werewolf. We're pretty strong.
Why'd you do that? Amberselli asked. I could hear someone muttering to her, and I guess she was getting advice from the other detectives around her. For a moment, Janelin's face looked blank. She hadn't thought of a motive, at least not a simple one. Then she said,
Kim stole my wallet from my purse, and when I tracked her down and made her give it back, she disrespected me. I have a bad temper, and she said some stuff that made me sick. I lost it. I have to go now. But I don't want anyone else blamed for something I did.
And Alcide hung up.
We'll hope that will clear Eric. That's our responsibility, he said, and nodded at Eric, who nodded back.
Janelin made her face hard and looked around, but I noticed she didn't actually meet anyone's eyes, even mine.
How'd she get these sleazeballs to help her?
Roy asked, jerking his head at the kneeling prisoners. He'd definitely been prepped.
She promised them membership in the pack when she became pack leader, Alcide told the Wares. Van is a convicted rapist. Coco burned her own family, father and two brothers, in their home. Laidlaw, though not convicted in a human court, was thrown out of his own pack in West Virginia for attacking a human child during his moon time. This is why I had turned them down for the Longtooth Pack. But Janelin would admit these people to run with us, and they did her bidding.
There was a long silence. Neither Van, nor Plump, Coco, nor Laidlaw denied the charges against them. They didn't try to justify themselves, which was pretty damn impressive.
What do you think we should do with the rogues?
Roy asked when the silence had lasted long enough.
What crimes did they commit here? Asked a young woman just past her teens.
They abducted Warren and imprisoned him at Janelin's family home. They didn't feed him and left him in an attic room without air conditioning or any means of relief from the heat. He almost died as a result. They abducted Sookie and were taking her to their own place, and we can only imagine what they would have done with her there. Those actions were at the behest of Janelin.
And she held out the promise of admission to the pack upon your death.
The young woman sounded like she was thinking hard.
Those are bad things to do. But in fact, Warren lived, and Sookie was rescued by the pack. Janilyn won't be your successor, and they won't join the pack.
This is all true, Alcide said.
So they acted about like you'd expect rogues to act, the young woman persisted.
Yes, not lone wolves,
Alcide explained for the benefit of the youngest wares present,
but rogues who've been turned down for pack membership, maybe by more than one pack.
And what about Candace? The young woman said, pointing to the short-haired rogue.
Candace told us what was happening because she didn't want to be a part of it, Alcide said. So we're going to put her membership to the vote in a month, after people have time to get to know her.
There was a general round of nodding, kind of guarded. Candace might have told on the other rogues because it was the right thing to do, or she might be a natural snitch. Getting to talk to her on an individual basis was the best course.
I think we should let these rogues go, called an older man. Blackball them from ever being a pack member anywhere. Put out the word.
Van closed his eyes. I couldn't tell if he was feeling relief or misery. Coco was crying. Laidlaw spat on the ground. Not smooth when people were deciding your life or death. In the end, they were released. It was unceremonious. Roy untied them and said, "Git." Eric looked away to hide his appalled reaction to such a lack of ritual. Laidlaw took off toward the east, running awkwardly because of his bandaged shoulder. Coco and Van went north. In a moment, they were out of sight, and that was the end of the rogues, as far as the Longtooth pack went. Janilyn remained. Responding to a gesture from Alcide, Roy untied her hands, and she stood to her unimpressive height, rubbing her wrists and stretching. Mustafa stood to face her on the sanded volleyball area.
I will kill you,
he said in his deep voice. He was not even wearing the dark glasses. Try, jungle bunny, Janilyn said, and held out her hand. She got a sword, too, handed to her by Roy. I was a little surprised. Execution seemed more in order than the right to fight, but nobody had asked me. She was trying to make Mustafa angrier with her insult, but the epithet didn't have any effect on him whatsoever. Some of the pack looked disgusted. The rest looked like people waiting for a sporting event to begin. I looked up at Eric, who seemed interested, nothing more. Suddenly, I felt like punching him. This woman had talked a desperate stripper into drinking fairy blood and seducing a vampire, both dangerous processes with unknown outcomes. Kim might have been reckless enough to risk her own death, but that didn't make Janilyn's scheming any less pernicious, or the pain I'd felt as a result any more bearable. I thought she deserved to die for what she'd done to Sam alone. His face was rigid with the effort of holding in his feelings. My heart hurt for him. The two combatants circled each other for a moment, and suddenly Janilyn executed one of her flying leaps, hoping to come down on top of Mustafa. The lone wolf pivoted, and his sword blocked hers. She went spinning to the ground, but she was up in a second and back on the attack. Mustafa had told me he wasn't sure he could win a fight with Janilyn, and for a few seconds she had the advantage. Not only did she hack away at him, this wasn't fencing, not like Robin Hood, but she shrieked, she screamed, she did everything she could to confuse and distract her opponent. I noticed that she was working gradually closer to the edge of the sand, closer to Alcide and Sam. She might be aware, but some intents were so strong I couldn't miss them. "She's after you!" I yelled in warning, and just as the words left my mouth, Janilyn leaped, spun, and came down on Alcide, who leaped aside at the last fraction of a second. She got Sam. He crumpled to the ground as his blood spurted. Janilyn paused in shock at having cut her lover, and in that moment, Mustafa grabbed her by the hair, threw her to the sand, and beheaded her. I'd seen beheadings before, but they're pretty spectacularly horrible. I didn't even remember Janilyn's until much later, because I was launching myself across the intervening space to crouch by Sam, who was bleeding out into the grass by the patio. I heard someone screaming and knew it was me. Alcide crouched down by me and reached out to touch Sam, but I shoved him away. Sam's eyes were wide and desperate. He knew the severity of his wound.
I started to call for Eric so he could give Sam his blood, but as I put my hand to Sam's neck, Sam's pulse stopped. His eyes closed. And everything else in the world did too. In my universe, everything fell silent. I didn't hear the chaos around me. I didn't hear a voice calling my name. I shoved Alcide away for a second time. My course was perfectly clear. I reached in my right pocket, pulled out the cluvial door, and put it on Sam's chest. The creamy green glowed. The band of gold radiated light. Amelia had always told me that will and intent are everything in magic, and I had plenty of both. Sam, live! I hardly recognized my own voice. I didn't have spells, but I had the will. I had to believe that. I pressed the cluvial door to Sam's heart, and I put my left hand over the terrible wound in his neck. Live, I said again, hearing only my own voice and the silence in Sam's body. And the cluvial door opened at its gold seam, revealing a hollow interior, and the concentrated magic inside it flew out and poured into Sam. It was clear and shining and otherworldly. It flowed through my fingers and into Sam's neck, and it vanished into the terrible wound. It filled Sam's body, which began to glow. The cluvial door, now empty of magic, slipped from my right hand, which rested still on Sam's chest. I felt movement with my left hand, so I pulled it away from the gash and watched. It was like watching a film run in reverse. The severed vessels and tendons inside Sam's neck began to knit. I held my breath, afraid even to blink or move. After a long moment, or several long moments, I could feel Sam's heart begin to beat under my fingers. Thanks, Fenton, I whispered. Thanks, Gran. After a small eternity, Sam's eyes opened.
I was dead, he said.
I nodded. I couldn't talk to save my soul.
What? How'd you do that?
Tell you later.
You can do that?
He was dazed. Not again, I warned him. That's it. You got to stay alive from now on.
Okay, he said weakly. I promise.
Eric left while I was with Sam. He left without speaking to me. When I got Sam to stand, we had to walk past Janelin's body. Sam looked at the corpse of the woman he'd dated for months, and his face was blank. He had a lot to process. I didn't give a shit about the rest of the Ware evening. I figured no one was going to challenge Alcide on the spot, and if they did, I wasn't going to stick around to watch another fight. I also figured if Mustafa wanted to join the pack, no one was going to vote against that either. Not tonight. I didn't even worry about the effect of tonight's spectacle on the smaller teenage Wares. They had their own world to live in, and they had to learn its rules and ways pretty damn quick. I drove, because I figured a guy who'd just died and come back probably should be left to think about the experience. Sam's truck wasn't hard to operate, but between driving an unfamiliar vehicle and remembering the way to get back to the county road to go home, I was pretty preoccupied.
Where'd Eric go? Sam asked.
I don't know. He left in a hurry. Without speaking, I shrugged.
Kind of abrupt.
Yeah, I said briefly. I figured his was the voice I'd heard yelling before I'd focused on Sam. The silence hung around and got awkward. Okay, I said. You heard about Freda. I figure he's gonna go with her.
Oh?
It was clear Sam didn't know what reaction to give me. Oh, I said firmly. So he knew I had this thing, this magic thing that I used on you, and I guess he thought it was kind of a test of my love.
He expected you to use it to save him from this marriage, Sam said slowly.
Yeah, evidently.
And I sighed.
And I kind of expected him to tell her to go to hell. I guess I thought of it as a test of his love.
What do you think he'll do?
He's proud, I said, and I just felt tired. I can't worry about it right now. The most I can hope for is that Felipe and his crew leave for home and we get some peace.
And Claude and Dermot are gone? To Ferry?
Yep, their own land.
They'll come back?
Nope. That was the idea, anyway. I guess JB is out of a job, unless the new management of hooligans wants him. I don't know what'll happen to the club now.
So everything has changed in the past few days?
I laughed, just a little. I thought of seeing JB strip, looking at the wet chair in Tara's shop, the faces of the babies. I'd talked to Mr. Cataliades. I'd seen Niall again. I'd bid goodbye to Dermot. I'd loathed King Felipe. I'd had sex with Eric. Donald Calloway had died. Warren had lived. Janelin had died. Sam had died. And lived. I'd worried and worried and worried about the Cluvial Door, which, I realized, I didn't have to worry about ever again. I was relieved when Sam agreed to spend the night in the spare bedroom across the hall. He and I were both exhausted for different reasons. He was still pretty shaky, and I helped him into the house. When he sat on the bed, I knelt before him to take off his shoes. I brought him a glass of water for the bedside table. I moved toward the door, walking as quietly as I could.
Sookie,
Sam said. I turned and smiled at him, though he wasn't looking at me. His eyes were shut, and his voice was already slow and thick with sleep.
You have to tell me what the Cluvial Door is all about, how you made it work.
That was going to be a delicate conversation.
Sure, Sam, I said, very quietly. Another day.
The End. You've been listening to Deadlocked by Charlaine Harris, narrated by Joanna Parker. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The Sookie Stackhouse Companion by Charlaine Harris, Victoria Kosky, and Beverly Batillo, edited by Charlaine Harris and narrated by actors from the Recorded Books Repertory Company. Charlaine Harris has become a nationwide phenomenon thanks to the unconventional and otherworldly life of Sookie Stackhouse. With the exclusive interviews, questions and answers, and a never-published-before novella, all in one exciting companion book to this series, take a closer look at Sookie and her family, friends, enemies, adventures, and, of course, the lovers who set her world on fire. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So visit us at recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.